Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, The Pirate Bay, the piracy site that refuses to sink. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
It's almost musical.
This is another of our special editions for CMU's 20th anniversary, looking back at the biggest stories we've covered in our first 2 decades. In fact, this is the last in that series, which we've been putting out over the last year.
Just as well, because we can't be celebrating CMU's 20th anniversary, because on the 18th of May, it was our 21st anniversary. So we're kind of out of time.
We said we were going to do it in a year, and I think we got closer than I expected.
Not quite, but nearly we are within our 12-month period of putting out our podcasts about the 20 biggest stories that CMU had covered in its first 2 decades in business before the 21st birthday occurred.
Yes, this is a story that took up a significant portion of those first 2 decades and, in fact, continues to be a story into our 21st year, so it remains relevant.
It's also continues to be a useful SEO tool for CMU.
Although less so.
Slightly less so than it was a few years ago. But basically, if the Pirate Bay, which is what we're here to talk about today, the Pirate Bay goes down, which it does relatively frequently these days, if we happen to report on it in a timely manner, it got to the point where we stopped reporting on it.
It goes down quite a lot.
Because otherwise, every few weeks, we'll be running basically the same article. But if we do run that article, because there are lots of people Googling the Pirate Bay, finding it's gone down, and then Googling where is the Pirate Bay, we get a flurry of traffic to the CMU website on our report saying, yeah, it's gone down, but it's not gone down.
Because we have written hundreds and hundreds of stories about what was once the most dominant piracy site. And most of those stories about efforts to shut it down. Although, to date, that has still not happened, despite police raids, a high-profile trial, prison sentences for its founders, and international efforts to stop internet users from being able to access it. It's still there.
Whatever you think about the Pirate Bay, and obviously a lot of people listening to podcasts work in the music industry, and probably think that it's evil enemy number one, although I suspect quite a lot of people have also used it at some point in the last 15 years. But there was a period in the mid to late 2000s when covering the Pirate Bay was very entertaining, because the founders, who had a public profile, then went to prison. So no one involved in a piracy site since then has had a public profile. But the founders, and in particular the founder who took on the role of being the spokesperson for this website, was good value for a time.
Yes.
And we're going to be talking about some of that today. In some ways, this 20th anniversary edition of Setlist follows on from some of the previous editions, because we've looked at other aspects of the piracy story, haven't we? And in particular, the Napster edition, where we looked at the early days of online music piracy and the rise of Napster, and then the litigation in the US against Napster that ultimately resulted in the Napster company, the original version of the Napster company, going bankrupt. That then set some precedents in motion, and we saw websites like Grokster, and then Kazaa, and then ultimately LimeWire, also facing litigation, mainly in the US, although in Kazaa's case in Australia, with the precedents that have been set in that original Napster case. So we had all of these big file-sharing lawsuits that were going through the motions in the early to mid-2000s. And in some ways, the Pirate Bay story follows all of that, because piracy had moved on, and the way the Pirate Bay was set up was slightly different. Although, the origins of the Pirate Bay come sort of in the midst of certainly the Grokster Kazaa conversations that were happening in the US, but the Pirate Bay originated in Europe.
Yes, so the Pirate Bay was founded in 2003 in Sweden by a group called Piratbyrån, which translates as the Piracy Bureau. That group launched in opposition to a Swedish government body, Anti-Piratbyrån. That's the Anti-Piracy Bureau, as you may have guessed. Originally, one of the site's founders, Gottfried Svartholm, ran the Pirate Bay on a server of a company he was working for in Mexico before moving it to Sweden, initially running it basically off a laptop by another co-founder, Fredrik Nige, although it quickly became necessary to employ more computing power to run it, as it very quickly became very popular.
Yeah, so I suppose it began as the website of this campaigning political organisation that had been set up to take on the entertainment industry's early attempts to combat online file sharing and online piracy, but then the website kind of outgrew the organisation and became much more well-known in Sweden initially, but then worldwide. And I said that, in some ways, this story follows on from the previous Setlist specials looking at piracy. And I suppose it's worth remembering that in the early 2000s, there were still lots of ambiguities in the law about file sharing and
yes.
about the rights and wrongs of sharing files online and whether or not people uploading were covered by the private copyright that exists under most copyright systems and what the liabilities were of the people who were uploading and then the liabilities of the people who were downloading, let alone the websites that were facilitating that process. And we were still waiting for some clarification on all of that. And in some cases, the clarification came through landmark cases like the Napster case, the Grokster case, the Kazaa case, the LimeWire case, mainly in American courts. And sometimes the clarification came from changes of the law. And in Sweden, where the Pirate Bay was kicking off, when it first started, when the website first launched, actually, I think I'm right in saying that under Swedish law at the time, it was generally agreed that the uploading bit of file sharing was copyright infringement, but the downloading bit wasn't.
Yes, and it wasn't until 2005 that the law was changed in Sweden to confirm that the downloading was also infringement.
But what that did mean was that by the time the Pirate Bay appeared on the radar of the music and the movie industries, we had got a little bit of clarity within Sweden, the Pirate Bay's home country, regarding the legalities of file sharing itself. Although there remained the question as to whether or not software makers and websites that facilitated infringement were also liable. And I suppose that's where it's worth looking at how the Pirate Bay was different to the Kazaas and Napsters and LimeWires that had gone before, in that all of those were bits of software that facilitated P2P file sharing, that connected up different computers on the internet and allowed the movement of files from one computer to another. Whereas the Pirate Bay was a little bit different, not least because a new form of file sharing had come along, which was BitTorrent file sharing. BitTorrent being an entirely legitimate technology that was designed to speed up the distribution of content over the internet. And it was required because most people, certainly who have a domestic internet connection, so if you have an internet connection from pretty much any ISP, generally speaking, the download speed that you get from your ISP is a lot faster than the upload speed. And what that meant was when you had P2P file sharing, so two computers were connecting, the upload bit was slowing things down, even if you then had quite a fast download at the other end.
Yeah.
So what BitTorrent did was it's a clever bit of technology that said, but what if 10 people were all uploading at the same time? And so they all upload a tenth of the file. And then a bit of technology glues all that data together and allows a single download. What if 100 people were uploading? What if 1,000 people were uploading? And so this new form of file sharing was starting to take off, which was speeding up the sharing of content between computers, which meant that file sharing, which initially had been predominantly used for sharing relatively small files. So one of the reasons why the music industry was the first to feel the horror of online piracy was that sharing an MP3, certainly a lower sound quality MP3, was possible under the early file sharing systems.
Yeah.
But as file sharing got faster, as BitTorrent came the norm, it became much easier to be sharing TV programs and movies and software, which was when other parts of the entertainment industry started to take notice. And the Pirate Bay was basically a search engine that helped connect computers together so that you could access files, whether they were music, movie, or whatever, through a BitTorrent file sharing system.
Yeah, so as BitTorrent file sharing became popular, so the Pirate Bay found itself becoming more popular. I mean, initially, their political motives behind launching it were entirely focused on Sweden, and it was focused on a Swedish audience. And then they eventually realized in 2005 that 80% of their traffic was coming from outside of Sweden, redesigned the site so that it had more of an international focus. And it kind of detached from that original pro-piracy group that set it up. In fact, that group disbanded in 2007 and was sort of superseded by the Pirate Party, which, although it doesn't have a direct link to the Pirate Bay, is sort of thematically linked, let's say. We're not really going to talk about the Pirate Party in the show, but that has grown in popularity and has gained seats in the European Parliament over time. So this definitely, that political link remains, although I think to a much lesser extent these days, but certainly it was there in the beginning. As it grew in popularity, it very quickly gained the attention of copyright holders, as you say, particularly the music industry, but also the movie industry as well.
I suppose the movie industry was really waking up to file sharing at this point for the reason I've just explained, which is as soon as we had BitTorrent file sharing, it became much more realistic to start sharing movies as well as music. So suddenly the film studios, who had been slightly protected from the early file sharing boom, suddenly started to panic in the same way the record companies were.
Yeah, so the takedown notices started to pile up at the Pirate Bay's, well, virtual door. People aren't sending takedown notices by post even back then. But the Pirate Bay generally responded to those in quite a mocking tone, which is something it had cultivated mainly through another of its founders, Peter Sunder, who acted as its kind of chief communicator throughout the early days of the site. And that certainly didn't help win it any fans in the entertainment industry.
As a result of that, the Swedish authorities came under pressure from the music and movie industries in Europe, but also in the US and from the US government as well, that this new big piracy platform, it's based in your country, you need to do something about it. And the Swedish authorities, well, they raided them.
Yeah, because by then it was using servers in a big data centre. That data centre was raided in 2006 by the Swedish authorities. I think it was like 85 police officers turned up. It was a big operation to take this down. And this is actually quite a pivotal point in the Pirate Bay's history, because shortly before that, Svartholm and Nige, two of the founders, had realised they were under police surveillance. And just before the raid happened, I think Nige, sort of on a whim, just made a backup of the site in case something happened. And then the data centre was raided, the site was taken down. And because he'd made that backup, it meant they could get it back online with another hosting company within 3 days. And this sort of set the tone for the future of the Pirate Bay. But it meant that they could kind of then, in their usual gloating, mocking tone, could say, look at that, all these police officers came, raided us, and you still can't get us offline, we're still here. And that became quite a running theme.
The three founders were questioned following that raid, and although they had a public persona, particularly Sunder, but as we understand it, they were perhaps predictably evasive in those interviews with the police. And as you say, made quite a big deal out of the fact that they were the anti-establishment rebels standing up for the internet users of the world against evil Hollywood and the record industry and the Swedish and American authorities, and they were going to stand their ground. And we went through a period of them not just sending snarky responses to the takedown notices, to issuing quite regular statements about how they were going to keep the Pirate Bay going. Of all of those statements, my favourite, because the legal problems were starting to mount up, as well as the Swedish authorities taking action in Sweden, litigation was starting to emerge, legal letters were starting to be sent. And then you had the issue that up until this point, most of the landmark file sharing cases had been in the US. Actually, Kazaa had begun in Europe, but then ended up being elsewhere. And ultimately, the Kazaa cases happened in Australia. So we started to get some questions being asked about where would they sue? Could they sue? What did the law say? But at one point, they put out a statement saying they were looking into buying this thing called Sealand.
Yes.
Which almost gives a bit of a UK element to this story for the first time. So Sealand is basically a platform in the North Sea, which was originally built, I think, in the Second World War.
Yeah, it was for anti-aircraft guns, I think.
And it's had a really interesting history. We don't have time to go through it now, but I do suggest, at the very least, if you don't know the story of Sealand, look up its Wikipedia entry, because it's a pretty good, accurate summary of what's happened there. At one point, a pirate radio station was based there, which makes it kind of funny. Yeah. But basically, what the Pirate Bay was saying was, we're going to buy this thing called Sealand, because at various points in the preceding decades, people had alleged that this platform in the North Sea was not in the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Therefore, outside the jurisdictions of the UK, outside the jurisdictions of any European countries. So the claim was, I mean, this is a claim that I think most legal experts would deny.
Yes, but the owners of Sealand still, I mean, they still operate it as an independent country.
They call themselves their own little nation state. And so what the Pirate Bay was saying was, what if we could crowdsource enough money to buy this platform? We could be our own country And then we couldn't be sued because we wouldn't be in any jurisdiction anywhere in the world. They didn't do it.
No, because, well, unfortunately, although Sealand claims to be an independent nation, it does sit within British waters and therefore would have been subject to British copyright law.
Although I suspect they never seriously intended to do it anyway. It was just
I mean, they said lots of things. There was the whole thing about putting it on servers flown around by drones so that it would constantly be moving in different territories and you could never track it to one particular one. That never seemed like something they were actually going to do either.
Quite a lot of silly statements were put out in these years, and you quite often got the impression that part of the motive was just to wind up the record industry and the movie industry and the authorities in Sweden who were starting to take some action in this whole, we're the rebels, we're anti-establishment, we're standing up for internet rights. So the Free Founders remained quite bullish throughout this period, although their legal woes were starting to mount in various countries, but especially back home in Sweden.
Yes, because ultimately they stayed based in Sweden, although they had backup servers elsewhere. But criminal charges were eventually brought against Svartholm, Nij, Sunne, and their financial backer, Carl Lundström. And in the run-up to their trial, which combined both criminal and civil charges at the same time.
Which you can do in Sweden,
which
apparently.
Which you can do in Sweden. They remained bullish then about their prospects. Sunne had said that he was expecting an epic win for the Pirate Bay in the case and claimed that the site's legal team were going to present bold new arguments in court that would completely exonerate them.
Now, for those of us who by this point had spent several years writing a daily bulletin for the music industry in which we had been covering all of this landmark litigation, Napster case and then the Grokster case, which went all the way up to Supreme Court in the US, and then all the Kazaa stuff. This talk from the Pirate Bay team that they were going to have some bold new legal arguments, because those cases, albeit, yes, in the US courts and then the Australian courts with Kazaa, I suppose, another jurisdiction, but what those initial Napster, Grokster, Kazaa cases had confirmed, certainly in the countries where those court cases were fought, was that companies that facilitated file sharing, so companies who provided software or other technology that allowed other people to share content without license, could be held liable for the copyright infringement they were enabling. Because as we talked about on the Napster special, Napster, like Grokster, like Kazaa, they all came to court with the same arguments, which was, our service has legitimate and illegitimate uses. We can't control what happens once our software or our service is out there. We're not actually hosting any of this infringing content. We're not actually actively involved in the infringement. We just set up a service that we thought people might like to share copies of their own content, of their own recordings. We're not just in this for piracy purposes. Therefore, if a few of our users, a few million of our users, a few hundred million of our users use our software to infringe copyright, not our problem, is what all the file sharing companies had argued. And in a whole series of cases, court said, no, you can be held liable for that copyright infringement because although it's true that your services have legitimate and illegitimate uses, it's not true that you have no control over how your technology is used because your server is ultimately still connected to your users' computers. And so at the very least, you could be putting some filters in place to try and stop your services from being used for copyright infringement. And even if those filters were 1% effective, at least you could try and do that. And none of the file sharing companies were. So in the US and in Australia and slowly but surely elsewhere, courts were saying that if you provide a service that allows people to infringe copyright online and you don't put any measures in place to try and stop that infringement, and if your communications, in the Grokster case, communications was part of it, if your communications suggest that people might want to use your service to infringe copyright, and let's just mind ourselves for a moment, the Pirate Bay was called the Pirate Bay. In most countries, courts were starting to say, yes, we can hold these services liable for copyright infringement. So when the Pirate Bay people came forward and said, aha, but we've got bold new arguments, from our perspective, it was like, well, we'd be really interested to hear what these new arguments are. Mm. Because it sounds like they're not just going to put the same arguments before a Swedish court and hope that a Swedish judge will find differently to an American judge or an Australian judge. We have new arguments coming forward. Are we interested to know what arguments they and their lawyers have come up with?
Yes. So when this came to trial in 2009, initially the Pirate Bay did score a bit of a win when right at the start, the prosecution dropped a load of charges relating to accusations of direct infringement, apparently up to the first day of the trial, having not realised that the Pirate Bay didn't host anything.
Yeah, I never understood why those were in there, because it had become the norm with file sharing cases by this point, that it was accepted that the websites, the software, the networks that were facilitating this infringement didn't actually host any content. They didn't actually get directly involved in the infringement. It was all about this question of facilitating infringement, what would variously be called secondary infringement or authorising infringement, or in Sweden, contributory infringement. So I don't know why those direct infringement things were even in there to start with, but they were quickly deleted. So yes, an initial win for the Pirate Bay at the start of the trial.
Yes, but when the Pirate Bay came to take the stand, they just argued that they didn't host any infringing content, so therefore couldn't be held liable for infringement. In fact, on top of that, they tried to add that they hadn't realised that people were using their software to infringe copyright. Let's remember that it was called the Pirate Bay.
So yes, they presented the exact same arguments that had been presented in all the previous file-sharing cases. There were no bold new arguments in there. So the only question really, once all the arguments had been presented in court in Sweden, was A, will a Swedish judge find in the same way as judges elsewhere in the world? I suppose B, this was also a criminal case, whereas most of those other cases I've mentioned were civil cases. Yeah. And so maybe when it comes to criminal liability, perhaps you set the bar a bit higher. Usually you do. So there was these two questions, which was, okay, no new arguments. They were lying about that. But we are looking at this under Swedish law. Will Swedish law find differently? Plus it's a criminal case. So maybe when it comes to criminal liability, they will win that side. But they did not.
No, all four of them were found guilty of contributory infringement and sentenced to a year in prison and fined £2.4 million between them. In response, the Pirate Bay issued a statement describing those prison sentences as bizarre and said that the fines couldn't and wouldn't be paid. A rep for Lundstrom, the financial backer, meanwhile, said that the sentence he'd received was outrageous. Svartholm did suggest at one point that if they could crowdsource paying off the fine in small increments of about 8 pence a time in quick succession, then the resulting banking fees would bankrupt both the legal firm accepting them on behalf of the music industry and the bank itself, and that would at least be funny, although they didn't do that in the end.
But even having been found guilty of criminal copyright infringement and facing a prison sentence, they were still putting out statements yes. designed to wind up the music and movie industries.
Yes, rather than launching that crowdfunding campaign to drive a legal firm out of business, they appealed the ruling. The major argument they used there was the judge overseeing the original case, Thomas Nordstrom, was biased because he was a member of two intellectual property organisations. The judge countered he'd joined those organisations in the run-up to the trial to be better informed about intellectual property issues.
Yeah, so I suppose the allegation on the Pirate Bay side was the judge was biased and was always going to rule in favour of the copyright owners because he's part of the copyright clique, whereas the judge was saying, this was quite a complicated copyright case.
Yeah, it was research.
I just talked to these copyright people so they had a full understanding of the intellectual property law that was at the heart of this dispute.
So that initial attempt to have the ruling overturned, and they were pushing for a complete retrial, that was knocked back. They said that they were going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court in Sweden. Although when it got to the Supreme Court, it was knocked back and there was no appeal heard.
I suppose an important point to mention is under Swedish law, in a case like this, although they had those prison sentences, they weren't actually going to be locked up until all routes of appeal had been exhausted.
Yes.
So it wasn't that they were taken to jail immediately after the sentence had been passed. They were told, okay, you can pursue all routes of appeal. And in most cases, not all four of them, which we'll come on to in a moment, but most of them did pursue several stages of appeal. As you say, ultimately, the Supreme Court wouldn't hear the case. Although at the main appeal stage, the ruling wasn't overturned, but the sentences were changed.
Yes, Nisch, Sunder and Lundstrom all had their sentences slashed to varying degrees. Lundstrom, the most, went down to 4 months and ultimately served his sentence under house arrest, although the others did go to prison. Even Svartholm, who didn't have his sentence cut because he didn't turn up for the appeal hearing, And so therefore it would just, the court just said, well, that stands. You still got to serve a year in prison. He hadn't turned up because his lawyer said he was hospitalised in Cambodia. Ultimately, he was extradited from Cambodia back to Sweden in order to serve his sentence.
Yeah, so although the financial backer basically did a deal and did his 4 months house arrest, yeah, the other three, I mean, it wasn't like they rocked up to jail and said, OK, I'm here, serve my sentence. There was quite a lot of effort required on the Swedish authorities' part to get them in to jail. I mean, you can understand why, I suppose, they weren't that keen to do their jail time. And I think they genuinely felt that they shouldn't have to. And getting them into jail in one case did involve a bit of Interpol action and an extradition treaty. And eventually, all four of them, despite having been bullish throughout, including after that initial ruling and throughout the subsequent appeal process, ultimately all of them did do their time.
Yes. Now, Sunne, not long after the trial, resigned from the Pirate Bay. He was the first of the founders to distance himself from it. A sale of the site was attempted and looked like it might go through for a time, although when it became apparent that the entertainment industry was going to come knocking on the door of anyone who bought it to try to get those fines paid, it did not happen.
That was a weird diversion for a moment. Yeah, this guy came out of the woodwork and said, I'm going to buy this and turn it into a legitimate business. He then had a really weird, confusing business model that Pirate Bay users were going to lease out, I think, processing power of their computers to other people. And that was what was going to pay all the... It was a really confusing business model they'd come up with, which is how they were going to take the Pirate Bay legit. That didn't happen. But, of course, as we've alluded to already, despite the raid, despite the criminal prosecution, despite the jail time, despite all of this, the Pirate Bay did continue. Ultimately, all of the founders officially stepped down, although there was some allegations that some of them were still involved, even though they said they weren't.
Yeah, well, there were rulings that barred them from being involved in it, which, I mean, Sunne put out a statement saying this was quite a strange ruling because it had been done in Sweden when he was living in Norway and he hadn't been part of the Pirate Bay for some time by that point. So he was barred from being involved with the site he wasn't involved with, which is what he said.
Yeah, by the time all of the appeals were going through the motions, the official line was none of the founders are involved anymore. A whole new team of people are now running the Pirate Bay, which, crucially, continued to operate despite all of this. And, somewhat sensibly, the people who took over running the Pirate Bay did so anonymously, having watched the founders do their jail time.
Yes, and they have made changes to the site over time, which Sunne particularly has been critical of. Certainly, it doesn't really have that political connection that it initially had. It's also been critical of the fact that it relies a lot more on advertising these days, which, I mean, back in the early days, there were claims by the entertainment industry that they were all raking in the money by running this site. And they said, no, any money we have gets funneled back into the site because actually it's really expensive to run because loads of people use it. Although now it does seem that there are attempts to run it as a profitable concern rather than some sort of political statement.
In addition to the landmark case in Sweden, which confirmed the liabilities of the site and its operators, litigation piled up all around the world. I mean, it must be one of the most sued websites anywhere. Once web blocking became possible in certain countries, like here in the UK, in most places, as soon as web blocking became an anti-piracy option for the music and movie industries, the first site at the top of the list always was the Pirate Bay. So the Pirate Bay have been sued, criminal prosecution, attempts to raid the servers. There were web blocks all over the world.
And there's been another major server raid more recently that happened. There was also that period when they thought that, so it always run on the .se and .org domains. And they thought, I think it was the .se domain they thought was going to be seized. So they moved, I can't remember what the first one was, but they moved elsewhere to a new domain and they kept moving around the world because everywhere they went to, the entertainment industry moved quickly and got those domains shut down. They spent a few months just going all around the world and eventually ended back at the .se domain, which hadn't been seized.
Yeah, that was a slightly bizarre thing that they'd always operated, as you said, on .org and .se. And I think it was that they thought .org was going to be claimed in the US. So then they started relying on .se. And then they thought that was going to be withdrawn in Sweden. And then they went on that tour around the world. But in the end, neither .org nor .se were seized. And weirdly, in Sweden, despite the police raids, despite the criminal prosecution, despite the jail time, Actually, the authorities have really struggled to claim the .se domain. They've tried, but to date, they have been unsuccessful. And so despite all of this, the Pirate Bay continued to operate. They did have some competitors to be the BitTorrent file-sharing destination of choice, and for a period, Kickass Torrents kind of took over as the big dominant player. But the music industry's attempts to shut down Kickass was a damn sight more successful. And ultimately...
Yeah, well, because it was shut down.
Kickass went. I mean, there is still attempts to hold the guy who ran it responsible under law. But as soon as the action began on that, the site was shut down, which gave the Pirate Bay another massive spike of traffic because suddenly the favourite BitTorrent file sharing hub had gone. Everyone went back to the Pirate Bay. And despite everything, site continues to operate in a way that whatever your opinions on copyright law, on liabilities of sites like this and the people that run them, on the impact of sites like this, on the music industry and on everyday artists, and whether or not you think the Pirate Bay is evil and everyone involved it was evil, it kind of gets to the point where it's pretty damn impressive that it's still going.
Well, when so many other sites have been taken down and it's still there. I mean, its popularity has waned over time. The entertainment industry's focus has moved kind of more onto safe harbor reform and attacking stream ripping sites. But it's still there. It's still running. You can still go on it. And, you know, assuming you can get around the web blocks, which I did while I was researching this.
Yeah, you almost certainly can. It doesn't take much more tech savvy than being able to use Google to find it, even in countries like this, where technically it is blocked. And so the Pirate Bay continues. You mentioned its popularity has waned, and in some ways that is a result of the legal streaming services that have popped up. Both the video sites like Netflix and Amazon Prime, but particularly on the music side, the Spotify's and Apple Music's of this world, have sort of shifted how people consume music so that you have a generation coming through for whom the idea of downloading content, particularly music, don't know what that means. Because what they want to be able to do is to go into a platform and stream the music that they want there and then. Which makes a site which is ultimately about downloading MP3s or movie files or whatever less and less relevant. And obviously, Sweden gave us the Pirate Bay. Sweden also gave us Spotify. And on the Spotify special set list, we talked about how in the early days, Daniel Ek was always talking about how his business model was a way of turning pirates, the people using the Pirate Bay, into legitimate users, initially through the free service and then through the paid-for service. And to an extent, Spotify and all the other streaming services have helped shift things forward so that we are getting to the point where download-based piracy, although it's still very much out there and the music industry continues to try and fight it, is starting to go into decline. And ultimately, that may be terminal decline, that the Pirate Bay will cease to be relevant. I suppose on the movie TV side, it still has an attraction because obviously the Netflix and Amazon Primes of this world are not free services, so people don't want to pay. Whereas with Spotify, if you don't want to pay, use the free version.
Yeah.
Whereas on the movie and TV side, if you don't want to pay, then maybe you still download. Plus, of course, even if you have Netflix and Amazon Prime, there will still be American TV shows. There will still be new movies that you can't access through those legit services, which possibly makes piracy an interesting option. But on the music side, there are still people illegally downloading MP3s. But generally, it was that period when the Kanyes of this world were doing exclusives with Tidal that you suddenly had another spike of illegal file sharing. Because if you lock your music to one streaming service, then maybe people will go back to the file sharing sites to try and get their illegal copy. But it does almost feel like at the end of that incredibly long story, all that litigation, all of those raids, all of that legal battling, that ultimately the Pirate Bay will only disappear once it has become utterly irrelevant to the average internet user.
Yes, it does seem increasingly likely that it will be the operators of the Pirate Bay who decide to shut it down rather than the music industry and legal authorities who forced them to.
So it may be that one day we tune into the internet and find that the Pirate Bay no longer exists. But as you say, that may well be not the result of some major litigation or criminal action or the authorities swooping. It may simply because the people running it get to the point where it's like, people don't want this service anymore. And maybe at that point, the Pirate Bay will finally go offline. But certainly as we record this, it'll be annoying if tomorrow it goes offline. But certainly as we record this, and hopefully by the time this podcast goes out, it will still be the case that for now, the Pirate Bay is still there. Obviously, we would never sanction anybody making use of it, but we all have to agree, I think, that this Pirate Bay story, particularly those first 10 years, have been, were, and maybe will continue to be quite entertaining to watch.
Yeah, and I hope that on the day they do shut it down, that they, just for old time's sake, put out one of those classic Pirate Bay statements mocking everyone. Because, I mean, that's the thing that we've really lost with the Pirate Bay, is they don't put out those statements anymore. They don't put any statements. They say nothing. That's a real shame, I think.
And if you're going to do that mocking statement, you're welcome to mock us in it, and we would look forward to that. Plus, of course, the day the Pirate Bay finally goes down, we will definitely report on that, and we will get the final flurry of traffic to our website of people Googling, where is the Pirate Bay? Assuming anybody is still Googling it at that point. I suspect there'll still be a few people Googling it who can then come through to our report. Finally, the Pirate Bay has gone, but who knows whether or not that's going to be in the next few weeks, next few months, or maybe a few years yet.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this special edition of Setlist. But it does now mean that our series of episodes for CMU's 20th anniversary is now complete, which means if this is the first one you've listened to, you can go back and listen to the whole thing in one sitting, I'd say.
We didn't necessarily publish them in chronological order, but if you go to the page on completemusicupdate.com, where we also have some little blurbs about each of the stories, and then they link through to the relevant Setlist special, that is kind of in chronological order. So, for example, with the piracy stuff, if you want to do it kind of in the order in which it happened, we haven't necessarily published them in that order, but you can listen to them in that order.
Yes, or if you go to the show notes for this episode at setlistpodcast.com, we'll link through to a playlist where you can play them all in the order that we published them, if that's how you want to do things. As I say, if it's the first time you've listened to Setlist, or it's the first time you've listened to one of these special editions, do go back and listen to every single special edition. If you've already listened to every single one, do go back and listen to them all again. I think it's well worth your time. And yeah, just do. I just want people to listen to them.
He's saying that because he had to do quite a lot of research for these.
Yeah, I put a lot of effort into these. Listen to them at two or three times.
Some of it was from memory, my memory, your memory. But Andy did spend quite a lot of time going through the CMU archives to pull out all the
various... and elsewhere, because this goes back to 20 years. And our website does not.
It's true.
Back 20 years.
The whole archive is not currently online. But next week, we'll be back to a normal set list where we look back at the previous week in music. But we have some other special series type stuff planned, which we'll tell you more about another day.
Yes. But for now, that's it. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. Edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.